Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're bringing you a story that was kept secret for 100 years. It's a family story that even the family didn't know.
100 years ago, women were not very familiar with their bodies and what was expected. So if he said, put your feet up, you know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later, people would be doing DNA testing and piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
This is part two of our story of Montreal's black market baby scandal. If you have not heard part one, I strongly suggest listening to that now. It's waiting for you on your feed. Have a listen. The title of part one is Black Market Babies. For those of you who heard part one when we first aired it last month, you might need a quick reminder. Here it is. Black Market Babies is the story, an underworld story, of an international baby smuggling ring in which hundreds of newborns were bought and sold out of Montreal in the 1950s. This resulted in international investigations, police raids, criminal trials. At its heart, this story of babies for sale is a story about families. And in this episode, it is told by the families. As you'll hear, both of our reporters today have personal family connections to the story that they're about to bring you. Like, very personal. One of our reporters' own mother was bought and sold. And our other reporter, their DNA tied her to one of the alleged masterminds behind the black market baby trade. So, here it is. Today, the shocking conclusion to black market babies. Wait for it.
I want to tell you a story about my great-grandfather. His name was Leon. Leon Azoulay. Dr. Leon Azoulay.
Dr. Azoulay, will you tell the court what happened on August 20th, 1947?
I was away from my office on a trip.
And the place where I'm going to start my story is the moment where Leon is about to take the stand in his own defense.
When I returned at around 1 p.m., the patient,
Blanche Lepierre of Beaupré, Quebec,
was in my waiting room.
The charge is murder. My great-grandfather Leon is a short, middle-aged man. Balding, his glasses round and clunky, and the fedora clutched in his left hand mark him as a middle-class man of the 1950s. Not the kind of guy you'd notice entering a room. Not even a courtroom. In fact, the reporters covering the two-week trial find him so nondescript, they pretty much fail to describe him at all, even when he's at the center of a murder trial. The courtroom press are far more taken with the sideshow. The Montreal Star wrote, "Again today, as in the past 2 days, the Court of King's Bench here resembled a medical lecture room, as doctor witnesses brandishing shiny surgical instruments and anatomical illustrations explained to judge and jury how and why Mrs. Blanche Lepierre, 40-year-old widow, could have met her death." Leon's murder trial was covered extensively by the local papers. The dialogue in this episode is taken from direct quotes he made on the stand, statements he made to police, court stenographer readings of his testimony, and reporter summaries of what he said at his trials.
"She did not seem seriously ill, so I asked if I could go have a shave. I returned around 2:15 and found her complaining of stomach pains. Gave her a quick examination, but before I could begin a more thorough investigation, she suffered a hemorrhage and fell off the table. 15 minutes later, she was dead."
I didn't have a normal childhood because, you know, for 10 years, we always had the aggravation of the trials or my mother crying while she's typing.
That's Harold Azoulay, Leon's son.
Because we couldn't afford typists, my mother would always be typing up appeals to the Quebec Board of Appeals or the Supreme Court of Canada. And she'd be typing there dead in the middle of the night, crying her eyes out while doing it. I remember these massive binders, you know, yellow pages. I don't know why that sticks with me, but they were definitely yellow pages.
What did you do after she hemorrhaged?
I raced around my office. I was everywhere at the same time. I had to stop the bleeding. She would be dead in 5 minutes. I was very anxious to save her life for her sake as well as for mine.
My father was frantic. He couldn't stop the bleeding. Now, she had fibroids, and he was using any instrument in his power to try and stop the bleeding. So he had to also take pregnancy instruments.
Fibroids are benign tumors that usually develop within the wall of a woman's uterus. And given the nature of fibroids, it would make sense that an examination would include the use of gynecological instruments related to pregnancy and abortions. During the trial, a policewoman described what she saw when she reached the crime scene.
I went into Dr. Azoulay's office and found the woman lying in a pool of blood in a side room. Her body was clad in a scanty garment, and the clothes were hung up nearby.
Harold is in his 80s now, but he remembers the father of his childhood the way many of us do, as a larger-than-life figure. Not only did his father speak 7 languages, English, French, Turkish, Arabic, Hebrew, Yiddish, and something called Ladino.
One of the languages he spoke was Ladino, which is the 15th century Spanish.
That's Yael, Leon's granddaughter.
And so he would invite the Spanish consul over and they would talk in Ladino. And the Spanish consul would find it really funny because it's like going to someone and speaking like Elizabethan English.
Leon also roared around Montreal on a motorcycle.
My father had decided to get married to my mother in Montreal. A week before the wedding, he decided to use his motorcycle and drive all the way to Montreal. I mean, she says, I'm his first love, but the motorcycle was the second love.
This love of motorcycles made Leon, at least in Harold's childhood eyes, the only doctor in town who did house calls in a leather jacket and motorcycle helmet. But that rebellious streak in his dad also tipped into risk-taking.
My father had a bad gambling problem, very bad. He loved it, you know. Now, sometimes he would make big and sometimes he would lose big. My mother said at that time, if you don't put us in the poorhouse, I don't care. Have fun. My mother, for some crazy reason, even with all my father's shenanigans, loved him like anything, you know. She said, I could not imagine living in this world without him.
After a 2-week trial, it only took 20 minutes of deliberation for the jury to reach their verdict. Guilty. Azoulay was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 7 years. The court judged that Lapeer had died while Leon was attempting to provide an illegal abortion. This amounted to manslaughter. According to newspaper reports at the time, apart from a slight flush, he took the news calmly. His wife burst into tears. The end of Leon's trial is just the start of our story.
To pack up and depart.
So like the challah is already made, the salad is already made, the vegetables are all
set up. And
yeah, the vegetables are all cut. So really like an hour before we eat, I'm going to throw stuff in the oven.
Perfect.
But really there's no prep left to do.
I'm in Montreal having dinner with Yael and Harold, and we're sharing family stories. You know, one of those family gatherings you have where an awkward subject comes up.
This was before the days of artificial insemination, so whether he used a cup and a syringe or another way. And I know that sounds weird, but even now in the 21st century, there are women of a certain age who really don't know their body parts, really don't understand their anatomy at all. So I would imagine 100 years ago, women were not very familiar with their bodies and what was expected. So if he said, put your feet up, you know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later, people would be doing DNA testing and piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
Family secrets. We've all got them. And this family secret is the one that hooked me on the story of Leon Azoulay. It wasn't the murder trial. That was on the public record. No. The family secret that dragged me down all these rabbit holes is further back. If we were in the Marvel Universe, what I'm about to tell you would be Leon's origin story. I've recruited Adam Siegel to help tell it. If you heard the first episode of this story, you already know Adam. But if you haven't, the brief bio is Adam Siegel, Toronto journalist, who has been covering Montreal's black market baby scandal for almost a decade. Okay, Adam picks up the story.
Let me set the scene. In true Marvel origin story fashion, a meteor streaks through the prairie sky, crashing into a field outside a small town in southern Manitoba. True story. It's the second largest meteorite of its kind to ever strike Canadian soil. And that meteorite is the claim to fame of a place called Elm Creek, Manitoba. In that town, there's a young doctor. His name, you probably guessed, is Leon Azoulay. This is 3 decades before his murder trial in Montreal. So the town has a local meteorite and a doctor, but what it doesn't have is a synagogue. So every now and then, Leon makes the one-hour trip to Winnipeg. There, he meets a married couple, Sam and Jenny. For 12 years, they've been trying to have a baby. Shortly after meeting Leon, miraculously, they do have a baby. And then another, and then another.
Suddenly having 3 kids after 12 years of trying? Maybe no more miraculous than a huge meteorite landing just outside a small prairie town. I mean, stranger things happen all the time. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Because Sam and Jenny are my great-grandparents. Yep, family secrets. A decade ago, I joined 23andMe. And you can probably guess, a whole new family tree sprouts. And I find out my great-grandfather isn't actually my great-grandfather. Well, not biologically. The DNA reveals my actual biological great-grandfather is Leon Azoulay, the doctor who befriended Sam and Jenny 100 years ago. I put the next obvious question to Elle.
Was there any chance it was an affair?
I doubt it. I think Sam and Jenny had a very strong marriage, from what I understand from their kids.
Yael and Harold are my blood relatives, but this is the first time I've met them. They're part of the 23andMe revelation. In trying to puzzle out Leon and my great-grandparents, we think Leon traveled from Elm Creek to the nearest synagogue, which was in Winnipeg. And there, he met Sam and Jenny. They became friends, and 23andMe revealed that all 3 of Sam and Jenny's kids were biologically Leon's children. So, okay, if it was an affair, maybe 1 kid would make sense. But 3?
I know everybody says my grandfather and grandmother were so in love. And I mean, certainly in looking at the DNA 23andMe, it's not like we have so many extra cousins. It's not like he was doing this to many women. It looks like it was really just this one couple that he had befriended.
So now, when we hear that earlier clip again,
whether he used a cup and a syringe or another way, even now in the 21st century, there are women of a certain age who really don't know their body parts. So if he said, put your feet up, you know, she wouldn't know what was in the syringe. They had no idea that 100 years later, people would be doing DNA testing and
piecing all this together. These were family secrets.
Nobody knows what happened when Sam and Jenny met Leon once upon a time. What I do know is that this motorcycle-riding gambler, this DIY artificial inseminator, this loving father and husband, this Ladino-speaking polyglot, this doctor convicted of manslaughter, collected one more title. Doctor on call for one of Montreal's notorious baby farms.
I think they called him King of Babyland.
Allegedly the center of a multi-million dollar, multinational baby smuggling ring.
As long as we have people and greed and money, we will always have some crime. But as long as we stay on top of it, we can keep it at a minimum.
We laid out the details of the black market baby scandal in our last episode. How the black market sourced babies.
Here's something that not many people know about the baby business. There are leg men. We call them leg men, though some of them are women, who make it their business to find pregnant women who are not married.
We met some of the smugglers.
My job is to smuggle black market babies out of Canada and into the United States. Yeah, I've been at it off and on the past 5 years. Maybe there's an easier way to make a bankroll, but I don't know it.
In our first episode, we told you how that underworld worked. Now, we need to take a look at the larger world the black market thrived in. Was Leon really at the heart of that underworld?
This is a massive church.
Gorgeous. Now we're standing outside St. John Baptiste Church in Montreal's Plateau neighborhood.
Look at the columns. They've got to
really
be 20 feet
statues,
high.
Statues. Arches.
It's hard to understate how small we are at street level when you're looking up towards this. I mean, this must have been the most dominant building in the neighborhood 125 years ago.
So this is a Catholic church, which means that probably if those women hadn't had those babies in Sarah Wyman's home, they would have been coming to some place like this to surrender them. And then those babies would have presumably ended up as orphans in the Duplessis system.
In the 1950s, when the black market baby ring was at its height, Maurice Duplessis was in the middle of a 15-year run as Quebec's premier. This would later become known as La Grande Noirceur, or the Great Darkness.
Imaginez-vous, Duplessis, ce dictateur.
Some of our opponents must be surprised. Imagine, Duplessis, that dictator, calls an election a year before he has to. Dictators aren't in the habit of calling elections, certainly not a year before it's necessary.
And during the Great Darkness, Duplessis' orphans were born.
The province had few social services and a powerful Catholic church.
What happened to Quebec's orphans in the 1940s and 50s under Duplessis' rule would become the biggest child abuse case in Canadian history, outside of the residential school scandal. Quebec's orphan system would sweep up thousands of children, but the provincial government was especially keen on one particular class of orphans. You see, for every orphan the province took in, the feds gave them $1.25 in subsidies. But for every psychiatric patient the province took care of, the feds shelled out $2.75.
Basically, if the province declared an orphan to be mentally unwell, the province would get twice as much money.
In one case alone, hundreds of children were institutionalized overnight when their orphanage was declared an asylum. A commission in the early 1960s found that 7,000 people were falsely declared to be psychiatric patients.
This is on top of other sadly familiar charges of systemic sexual and physical abuse of the orphans.
So, an unwed Montreal mother in the 1950s who did not want to or could not keep her baby had the following choice. Either surrender her baby to the black market or to the Great Darkness. But there's one more piece of the puzzle.
So we're standing at 4351 Avenue L'Esplanade in Montreal's Plateau. We're just below Parc Jean-Mons. It's people playing tennis, barbecuing, enjoying a Saturday afternoon. This is formerly a B&B called Casa Bianca, and as I can see, and Alana, you can see, it's a completely white brick house. Why are we here? Because my mom in the 1940s was born in this exact building and sold to childless Jewish parents from Edmonton. My grandmother and grandfather came out here on the train in late 1945 and awaited a phone call. They paid $10,000 for her, and by the end of January, she had a birth certificate that named her adoptive parents as her parents.
If you're really going to get the full picture of what adoption was like during de Plessis' years, there's one more piece of the puzzle. It was called religious matching. Premier de Plessis was a devout Catholic, and his provincial government enforced a policy known as religious matching. Any unwanted babies born to a specific faith had to be adopted into families that practiced that same faith. Catholic babies must be adopted by Catholic families. Jewish babies must be adopted by Jewish families. There was just one problem. There were a lot of unwanted Catholic babies and not a lot of unwanted Jewish babies.
In 1951, 400 Jewish couples reported adopting children in Quebec. Yet police claimed that only 4 illegitimate births were reported by Jewish women. The law won't let Jewish people adopt children from Catholic mothers. So where were the 400 babies adopted by Jewish families coming from?
Of course, they told my parents that I was Jewish. They promised.
That's Francine George. We met Francine in episode 1. And just like my mother, she was sold on the black market.
I was never told I was adopted. I believed I was born to my mother in Plainfield, New Jersey. I found a picture of my mother, my adoptive mother, on a beach. And the photo was dated September 5th, 1951. She was in a bathing suit. So I asked her, why aren't you pregnant?
English and French newspapers estimate that thousands of Catholic children were trafficked out of Montreal and sold to gullible or naive Jewish parents.
My mother used to say, they promised us you were Jewish. You're Jewish. I know you're Jewish because that lady told us you were Jewish. And my father used to go, who cares?
So that's the world Leon lived in. The pressures of church and state filling orphanages, but adoption made difficult by religious matching laws. The rise of a lucrative baby smuggling network across Canada and down into the U.S. And eventually, the court and newspapers placed Leon at the heart of that smuggling ring. But why? In 1952, Leon had been convicted of manslaughter and was out on bail and appealing the conviction when the press accused him of being at the heart of the baby smuggling ring. Basically, he was alleged to be delivering babies in illegal maternity homes, or what the press called baby farms.
From what I heard from my mother, he was just doing a good deed.
Leon's son Harold remembers that good deed and what it led to.
This young teenage girl was destitute and she was going to give birth and she couldn't afford it. She didn't know what to do. This lawyer had approached my father and said, if you ever come across a case of somebody who needs to sell their baby, you know, let us know.
Leon delivered the woman's baby, and he called that lawyer.
This really sad story where the girl had delivered out of wedlock, signed away the baby, and then the boy in her life came back. And she wanted to get the baby back, so she accused my grandfather of kidnapping the baby.
A big question for me in trying to understand Leon's murder charges was this. A woman showed up in his office and bled out on his table. He was accused of killing her, while trying to perform an abortion, which he denies.
The baby might have been deceased 10 hours before the patient came in to see me. An abortion would have been impossible at the stage she was in. I did nothing to cause the bleeding. I hadn't even begun an internal examination.
He says he was just there to help with her onset of pain caused by fibroid tumors. He says he had been treating her for fibroids for 3 or 4 years, and she came to his office complaining of abdominal pains. If he hadn't given her an abortion, as he testified in his many trials, what exactly was he supposed to have done differently? Yael is a physician, so she has some perspective.
It happens that people bleed. Mm-hmm. It happens that no matter what you try, you can't stop the bleeding. But you have to at least try. And one person alone can't do everything.
Yeah.
So he would have needed help. He would have needed someone to call an ambulance. He would have needed extra help.
Her death was the greatest emergency of my life. I did everything I could to keep her alive.
At the time, Leon worked in a building on St. Catherine Street. And there were other doctors working there, too.
From what my mother described, he called for help. People came in and looked in, saw a woman bleeding, and walked away. And the other thing is a woman died needlessly because all the colleagues wouldn't come to help him because they were so terrified of being associated with an abortion. Had there been other doctors and nurses coming in to help, they could have brought up her pressure. They could have stopped the bleeding.
Did the other doctors refuse to help because they thought Leon was conducting an abortion, which in those days was often seen as tantamount to murder? So Leon was left to try to save her himself. Blanche LaPierre died, and Leon Azoulay was charged with murder. Over a 10-year period, he faced 6 trials for abortion, murder, and for being part of the black market baby ring. One by one, the charges against him fell apart. On April 5th, 1957, a headline ran in the Gazette. Standing verdict. Dr. Azoulay free after 10 years. Then, 10 years after that headline, he was dead.
The last 10 years, he couldn't practice at all. He had developed a heart problem because of all the anxiety, you know. 10 years in front of the courts, I think he had 3 or 4 heart attacks over a 5-year period.
I want to tell you another story about a young man. His name was David Elkin. And the place where I'm going to start my story is the moment where David is 15,000 feet in the air and on the brink of disaster. Navigator David Elkin and his crew have already dropped their payload on the railway yards in Hanover, Germany. He's only 21 years old, but as navigator, it's his job to guide the crew back home. In the last 3 months, he's pulled it off 24 times, but this time is different. Your plane is hit. The engine bursts into flames. The pilot yells for everyone to bail. You clip on your parachute and open the hatch under your seat. Your crewmate is sitting on the floor crying. His parachute accidentally opened too soon. It sprawled out around him on the plane's floor. The smoke is thick. You jump. The plane explodes behind you. You fall through the dark night, Nazi Germany rushing up to meet you. You pull a letter from your pocket. It's from your grandmother, written in Yiddish. You tear it up. I found this story in a memoir my grandfather, David Elkin, wrote about his time in the Royal Canadian Air Force. Clearly, he survived that parachute drop into Germany, was a POW, and made it home to start a family.